You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week, we head out on a paranormal road trip around some of Wisconsin's most haunted locations, and Chad Lewis is firmly in the driver's seat. We encounter strange balls of light, mischievous spirits, some gnomes, serial killers, haunted bars, the strange story of Captain Santa, and probably the oddest animal ghost story I've ever come across. As always, Chad educates and enthralls us with some spine-tingling tales from the Badger State. As always, though, before we get there, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Thank you, as always, to each and every one of you that supports the show through Patreon. It means a great deal. Thank you for your continued support. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, including something called Threads, which is new, apparently. So you can find us on there. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. And please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Thank you, as always, to Dean Bestor for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So let's hit the road in the company of Chad Lewis as we go on the hunt for some of Wisconsin's most notorious haunts.
Let go of your reality and step into a realm beyond your wildest dreams.
A place where the veil between the living and the dead is paper thin.
Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances. I'm Mike Brown.
And I'm Morgan Knutson. Join us and the world's leading experts as we deep dive into stories about poltergeists, cryptids, and other tales of the unexplained.
Search for and follow Supernatural Circumstances on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Thankfully, my next guest has survived a trip to Murfreesboro to help them celebrate the inaugural Big Muddy Monster Festival to join me to dive into his latest book. In Chad's latest tome, he takes us out on the road to visit some of the Badger State's most haunted places. Chad, welcome back, sir.
Thank you for having me. I feel reborn after surviving another Bigfoot festival, and life is all anew for me. Everything seems new and exciting. Like the first time I've ever been here, although I've done the show 63 times, I think, but this feels like the first.
As always, it's never a chore. It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Chad.
Yeah, always fun. I mean, the listeners don't know this, but the conversation on our end just goes so quick, and it just feels like it's just done in a flash. So always glad to be here.
No, and I'm always glad you're welcome to join me in any time. So thank you as always, my friend. So, as I said on the introduction, you've had a very hectic weekend down at Murfreesboro in Illinois. They've just launched their first sort of foray into the world of the Cryptid Festival, Chad, and it sounds like it's been a superb success. And they've also unveiled this incredible statue outside one of the new hotels in the town. So it seems like everybody in that particular area is now supporting and falling in love with their own cryptid creature.
That's possible when you're in a town of 8,000 people. Things can get done. The mayor was the one who unveiled the statue to the town. All the business people, the developers, everyone was there behind it. And that makes a huge difference when you get the kind of movers and shakers along with the community supporting it. That the first night it was revealed, Kevin Nelson and I were just sitting down at it at night after it got dark and everything calmed down. And it was 11 p.m. at night, and cars were still rolling in to take a photo with it at night. So it's going to be amazing. And I think the town's really going to benefit, and people as well, that they can go to this town. And instead of wondering where the heck did everything happen, or where can I, you know, get a photo or experience the legend, They say, oh, that's a 9-foot Bigfoot there. Let's start with that.
And long may it continue, because once again, we've got a small town, probably would have, to some people, Chad, they would perhaps suggest that places like this, once again, have their best days are behind them. But here's a little place that's gone, well, people who've never been here know all about this story due to their love of cryptids and Bigfoot creatures and the mysterious. And so it becomes one of those sort of legend trips now for people, where they can view, as we've mentioned previously, Point Pleasant and all the support that you get in regards to building up the Van Meter Festival now. It's inspiring to see these little towns take a turn to the strange to really sort of invigorate their tourist applications and invitations that people want to now come to this town to have their picture taken with this incredible statue.
That's exactly right. Paranormal tourism is exploding. And I think it fits in well to what we're talking about today, because when I first did 20 years ago, when I first was working on my Wisconsin Haunted book, wherever I went, whether it was a theater, a restaurant, a hotel that had a haunted story, they would tell me, we don't want to be in your book, because if people find out we're haunted, nobody's going to come here. But then they always kind of joked and said, go ahead, put us in your book. Who's going to read that thing anyway? And now they email me saying, thanks so much for putting us in the book, because it is a tourist draw. It is something that people are specifically looking for. I've had mother-daughter weekends, family vacations, bachelor and bachelorette parties, geocaching, all going to paranormal hotspots as a form of adventure.
Well, I suppose it's one of those things that often I find it quite confusing, because you can't go 200, 300 yards in this country of mine, Chad, in a town or a city centre without somebody advertising themselves as the most haunted pub there. So it's always surprising when I hear places are quite reticent about being included in a ghost book or anything to do with paranormal investigations. Whereas here, they're always uploading their own things, going, oh, we've got a ghost in our pub. Come and have a drink.
It is changing here. You have more and more places embracing their history, their folklore, even if they don't necessarily believe in it or believe it's true. They love the legend. They love the folklore. They love the romance of it all. So that's changing here in America as well. There's a place in northern Minnesota that's well known as a haunted hotel. And the owner, she told me that she thinks about 80% of the guests come there specifically because they want to see a ghost. So take away 80% of any business, and that business usually will not be there.
Well, once again, people embracing different things to give them a revenue stream that they probably would never have thought of until they've appeared in a book or somebody's mentioned them online or whatever, Chad. So fair play. It's a clever marketing tool for a lot of places, I would imagine, that otherwise, as we've just been talking about Murfreesboro, most people wouldn't have a reason to go there.
Pass right through. But now you have the opportunity to have a paranormal experience or learn some history and enjoy. And I think people are searching for that newness, that uniqueness that can only be found there, that you can't just find the mud monster anywhere. You have to go to Murfreesboro. So good on them. It's the same, I always say, as if they discovered oil or gold in their area. Of course, they're going to use it to benefit the community. This is just gold in a different type of a legend.
Absolutely, absolutely. Cryptid gold. This is the real cryptocurrency, you could suggest, Chad.
Yes, I think every time we speak, we come up with these business ideas. So a cryptid currency with Murfreesboro and others. I think you can go to your website and find more information about that.
I think we'll do some talking off air about that business proposition, I think, Chad.
Yes.
So obviously, as we say, your latest book or sort of a sort of updated and newly available version of the Wisconsin Guide to Haunted Places is currently out there, Chad. And I know that once again, as we're talking about it, when you originally pulled this book together, it's the best part of two decades ago. Was it one of those situations where you had a list of the original locations that you went and revisited to see if anything changed or you had any more new reports, or was there anything that's been added that you weren't aware of when you first pulled it together?
As you can imagine, after 20 years of being in print, things change. So when I decided I wanted to do something new, so I struggled with how much new versus how much old stuff to put in there. And all the old stuff is newly updated. I had new cases, new witnesses coming forward, new legends. So the stuff that appeared in the first book, the best places, I kept my favorites and stated them. But then I also added new stuff that I had never heard of or that were very obscure legends. And it's always a tricky balancing act because, you know, as an author, you assume everybody has your first guide. So the new one has to be all new. But realize very quickly that the majority of people buying the new one didn't have the old one. So if I want to put some of the more infamous cases in the new one, as well as the old one, people would say, why don't you have that one in there? So I think it's a fresh take. And again, after 20 years, some of the places changed. Businesses are no longer there, or they've changed their direction. Forests that were thought to be haunted are now parking lots or, you know, Target stores. So, and then some weren't just very scary. I remember in the first book, we put in a haunted subway restaurant, which is a, you know, fast food submarine place here in the States, where kind of fun story, but is anyone thinking, hey, let's all get in the car and go check out a haunted subway restaurant?
Well, stranger things have happened, Chad. Who knows?
True. So, yeah, it was fun going through and saying, what can I keep? What can I get rid of? And you know, what are the new stories from some of the favorite places? And then also you have to do it based on geography, that you want it spread out through the entire state. And I wanted different sorts of places where most of them are open to the public 24 hours a day. You can go there. You don't have to worry about it ever closing. Others are bars or hotels, but a lot are outdoor, free, open to anyone brave enough to venture out there.
I suppose as well, as you touch on there, it's one of those difficult decisions. What makes the cut without sort of treading over old ground as well? Because there will be some that are very notorious, or people may think that they know all about them, Chad. So I suppose that would have taken the hardest part of the book, in my opinion, for you to shake out what you didn't want to find anymore, or did you think that because the quality of these new cases had come, like you say, people visiting haunted subways, was it easier than it looks on first glance?
Hardest thing for me is to keep it at a level that the average enthusiast would enjoy. And what I mean by that is, if I was doing a book, no limits, nothing, didn't care about sales, I would do the biggest book you've ever seen, and I would include every single place I've ever heard of in Wisconsin, and it would be the definitive guide, and you'd need a pickup truck to carry it around with you. But the majority of people out there aren't necessarily as interested in it as I am, that they want the stories, but they want the best stories, that they're not looking to read 700 pages on it and get bogged down with it. So that was the hardest for me, is to realize that not everyone is as crazy as I am, that people want different things. So, and I think any author has to address the idea, do you want to get this out to, you know, maybe 15 scholars that all kind of know what you know, versus the general public that you might be informing them of something new? And I usually try to err on the side of the general public, just because I hate preaching to the choir.
And I think as well, it's always good for people to have a book like this, because as you say, you've broken it down into certain parts of the state. So if people are sort of time constrained, or they've only got a couple of days, they can sort of hunker down in a specific area and maybe make return trips to try and capture or experience some of these weird things that are going on. So I suppose it also helps that you've broken it down into sort of bite-sized sections for people to focus on.
The actual chapters themselves are bite-sized, where I've had many people that never travel to these places. They read one story a night as a family or friends, and they just kind of at bedtime read a story about a place. And that really was what I was shooting for, is that it's not filled with a lot of filler. So some of the things I touch on the history, but I don't get into great detail of the history that's non-paranormal related. And I think it's interesting the different type of people that like to read it versus like to read it and then go experience it. Mm-hmm. And I think both are doing what's right for them.
Yeah. Well, I think the first story that jumps out to me when I was reading this, and it's one of those where I just scratch my head and think, well, I've never heard of a story like this from the Western part of the world, I would suggest, Chad. And this is this intriguing story about phantom elephants. And there's also, as you were explaining to me earlier before we started, there's a strange connection with Wisconsin and elephants, Chad.
Wisconsin is the circus capital of the world, not in terms of originating, although both Ringling Brothers and P.T. Barnum, the Barnum and Bailey Circus origins are from Wisconsin. Huh. But we had over 100 circuses originating here in Wisconsin. And they love to use Wisconsin as their winter quarters. And you would think that would be very odd to have such a cold place for your winter storage of the animals and all the equipment. But keep in mind that we had plenty of water. We had plenty of agriculture. And an elephant can eat, you know, several hundred pounds of hay a day. It can drink 60 gallons of water. And now imagine you have 20 elephants, 200 horses, 4 camels, some zebras, a hippopotamus, and the like. You need land and you need food and water.
Yep.
And plus it allowed you to start the season earlier because all the Eastern circuses could not make it here in time. You know, this was when you were using horse and buggy to pull all of your wagons, and travel was maybe 10 miles per day. We have a lot of history, and the haunted elephant one I put in is one of two haunted elephant locations in Wisconsin that I know of. But I felt like I couldn't put the other one in there because it would take away, like, how many phantom elephants do you have there in the state? So I put the one from my hometown of Eau Claire, the one that always intrigued me, and it dates back to the early 1900s when a circus was coming through and a huge storm plagued them. Lightning striking hit many of their elephants that were collapsed on the side of the field. And one elephant, Ella, actually died being hit by lightning. And as soon as she died, her body was all cut up, and snake oil salesmen were grabbing pieces of the body of the elephant to sell it as cure-alls. So what was left of Ella was buried. Just what do you do with an elephant when it dies? You bury it right where it is because you're not moving it anywhere. And the legend is that people have seen this phantom elephant walking up and down two major hills in Eau Claire. And they swear maybe the circus is in town and there's a circus parade. But when they get close, the thing's either transparent or simply vanishes right into thin air.
I mean, that's one of those excellent points that unless people mention it, Chad, you don't really think about it. And you look back and you think, well, how many circuses had elephants? And how many must have passed away over the years? There must be, sadly, elephant skeletons buried all over the place in the U.S., you would imagine.
There's a legend here in Wisconsin, down in Delavan, where the P.T. Barnum show got started, that one of their elephants, Romeo, who was a nasty elephant, did not like being contained, killed many people through the years, that when he died, again, they were left with, what do we do with this thing? It was winter. They couldn't dig a hole big enough in the frozen ground. Backhoes didn't exist. So they hooked up a chain from their other elephant, Juliet, and the legend is they just cut a big hole in the ice and had her drag the elephant out and let it just fall into the ice. Oh. Others say they just left it out on the ice and waited for the ice to melt and then waited for the elephant to sink to the bottom. Now, I don't know if it really happened. I'm still investigating this legend, but you know, the idea of an elephant floating or dropping to the bottom is very interesting, but things were different in the 1800s.
Absolutely. Well, I'm just glad they didn't take some dynamite to it, Chad, because obviously there's that infamous incident in the US. I forgot, was that in California where a whale had unfortunately passed away and washed ashore, and the local town thought the best way to deal with it was to blow it up with dynamite and film it live?
I don't know that one. That sounds fantastic if that's what they did.
They made a big thing of it, and all the local news came down, and all the residents were around watching it going, oh, this is exciting to watch it. And so all the reporters were there going, this is what's going to happen. I'm trying to think where it was now, but it was definitely somewhere in the States.
Remember, in America in the 1800s, nearly every farmer had dynamite because they would use it to get rid of stumps and trees in their land. It was the easiest way to do it. So dynamite was everywhere.
Yeah. So this incident happened in Florence in Oregon in 1970. And so everybody was aware of a whale that had been washed ashore and sadly passed away, Chad. And to save money, they just sort of moved a cordon around it and decided that they'd blow it up. And if you go on YouTube, if you look for the Florence whale incident, you will find the actual news report and the rather amusing afterwards, where sadly everybody seems to be covered in blubber.
Well, that's, I guess you said 1970?
Yes.
That's amazing that it would happen in 1970. I'm going to have to look that up. That's fantastic.
So, yeah, you never know. There may have been people who thought, like you say, Chad, a lot of people back in the old days would have had access to things like dynamite that they would just keep in the shed and stuff. So I would not be surprised if there are more strange stories of sadly passed away animals being dealt with through the power of dynamite across the world.
The thing I love about putting these books out is that oftentimes after the story gets out there, you get other people contacting you that may have had an elephant sighting in Eau Claire, but thought, nobody's going to believe me. Who am I going to report that to? But then they read that, wait a minute, other people have been seeing it as well. So I'm always amazed at how many people feel more comfortable coming forward once a legend is out there. So I'm hoping to have more elephant sightings throughout Wisconsin.
I suppose for you, Chad, as well, when you're dealing with these strange stories, is this the strangest animal ghost that you've come across? Because whilst it's not unusual for an elephant, you know, most people, like you say, as you say in the book, lots of people would go to the older circuses, especially, and it would be the first time they would see an elephant, and they would all be amazed at it because that, you know, living in these small towns, they'd never have access to say a zoo or something, or even television in the earlier part of the 20th century. So is the phantom elephant of Eau Claire the strangest animal story you've come across in the States?
Well, it's the biggest. and you're right. Your circus wasn't considered a circus until it had an elephant. Until then, you weren't a real circus. So, and you're right again that many people would come to the circus for the animals. And it worked on two parts, is like you said. This was back prior to even radio, that they had never seen many of these animals in person and they'd never have a chance. But also many of these small religious communities would accept that you could go to see the animals and not the circus, because the animals were a direct line to Noah's Ark, that yeah, it had educational purposes and religious purposes. So the circuses would often display these animals on their own, and you could go, and the kids from school would all go and see it, and it would be considered educational. And then, of course, you could have the demon circus there too. So they were all over, but we have all sorts of phantom animals in Wisconsin, the strange but yet acceptable type, like phantom cats, phantom dogs, phantom kangaroos, phantom chickens, you name it, phantom pigs. We have it all. So, but elephants, yeah, definitely the strangest, because they're ones that just aren't native to our state.
Yeah. I would imagine as well, as you say, Chad, the chances of, and I know you mention it in the particular section in the book, one of the witnesses was driving a car and saw an elephant lumbering up a hill. And you have to think, even if you don't think it's a ghost, imagine when you get home and say, well, I'm sure I've just seen an elephant walking down the street. Whether or not it's a ghost or not, people wouldn't believe you.
That's exactly right. Now, Baraboo, Wisconsin also has a legend of a ghost elephant, but they also have Circus World Museum there, which is on the Ringling Brothers winter headquarters from the old days. And they have circuses performing all summer long. And this is the last year they actually have elephants there. They're retiring them for good next year. But in 2000, and they have a phantom story that goes back to the 1950s about a phantom elephant. But in 2017, I got real excited because people in Baraboo were reporting seeing an elephant walking through their backyards, trampling the gardens and the like. So I thought, this is awesome. It's the return of the phantom elephant. But turned out it was just an escapee elephant from the Circus World Museum. And it was roaming people's backyards, and they were able to bring it back to its quarters. So for a while there, I thought, the phantom elephant returns.
Oh, well, it's one of those strange things. I know there was a couple here in the UK who've recently won some compensation, Chad, after a herd of water buffalo decided to use their swimming pool for the afternoon, just smashed up the garden, and they'd all escaped from a local farm.
Oh, that's great. I mean, if you're that homeowner, you got to accept it of just being, you know, fate for these animals to come into your pool. How cool is that?
And they caught it all on CCTV as well, so we had the footage of them splashing about and jumping in and out of the pool. So it's not what you expect to see in the south of England.
Yeah, certainly.
Oh, I mean, one of the other things we've touched on this on some of our previous conversations is this: the amount of haunted bridges or legends attached to bridges, even outside of Wisconsin, is remarkable. Really, there's certainly nothing I can compare it to here in the United Kingdom with the amount of legends attached to certain bridges here, Chad. And one of the ones, I mean, the thing about this book is, yes, it's a wonderful collection of stories, but some of them are quite sad. And the Siren Bridge one is quite an emotive sort of birth to this legend. And I know when we've spoken previously, we've talked about one of your many talents is that you're able to sort of dig down and drag out the truth in regards to some of these legends, that where they come, are they just tall tales told by school friends or you know, friend of a friend stories? But often when you go back to a certain point, you can see the sort of the germ of this legend being born. And Siren Bridge is one of those that seems to be quite recent as well, because of this tragic incident that occurred there.
It really is. And it's one of those where for years I was hearing stories about this small little bridge in northwestern Wisconsin where Siren is, and people would pass over the bridge and all sorts of weird things would happen to them, usually electronic of their car radio. One person told me that they were driving over the bridge listening to a death metal station, heavy metal, when all of a sudden when they passed on the bridge, it switched to Christian station, a religious station. And then when they hopped off the bridge, that went back to the original music they were listening to. And there's other accounts of people driving over the bridge and they'll hear what sounds like a young child crying for their mother, yelling for their mother. And for years this was happening and nobody really knew why. And it turns out that I started digging up, and that a family of three, the mother, father, and young daughter, were driving, and it's back roads, and it was a storm, and they lost control and went into the river and died, unfortunately, met their watery grave and died in the cold there. And now many people believe it's that daughter forever trapped looking for her mother and crying out for anybody who passes over the bridge. And it's just a slight variation on your crybaby bridge stories.
Mm.
Throughout the entire world, people have crybaby bridges where when you go to the bridge, you hear usually an infant crying. But often there's no origin proof of this legend. It's always a, you know, a group of carload of kids that met their fate there when a semi hit them, or a mother disposing of her child there, all those, but they usually don't have anything you can pinpoint to. Well, maybe this is the start of the legend. Maybe this is why. So the Siren Bridge is pretty interesting because we do have the newspaper reports of the family meeting their fate there, the unfortunate accident, and then the legend springing up around it.
Well, I suppose as well, Chad, at that point, you're able to say, right, looking at historical pamphlets and other books that may have been written that predate this accident, is there no mention of this legend before this accident in 1985? And it's as we were saying, it's one that's certainly got a more modern feel to it, because some of the ones we've spoken about previously are sort of, you can trace them back to the beginning of the 19th century, and it gets really murky when you try and find the origin point.
This one's interesting because I don't have any reports that predate the accident. There may have been, but I'm not familiar with any. But also, I'm not familiar with any other legends in general of that bridge, because sometimes you'll have a haunted story, you find an origin of it or an alleged origin, but the story predates it. You may have a UFO legend predating that haunting by 40 years. So sometimes these places are these window areas or beacons or paranormal hotspots where so many things are happening that it's hard to find an origin. But as far as the Siren case goes, I didn't start hearing people talk about it until the 1990s. So it gave it a few years. They could have been talking, but again, a lot of these people don't know who to report it to or don't want to report it. So we know the overwhelming majority of sightings and encounters simply never get reported.
I mean, this one is quite chilling as well, because I know one of the other witnesses you talk about drove over the bridge and their radio was interfered with a young girl screaming for her mother, which I would imagine it doesn't matter where you are, who you are, or what time of day or night it is, Chad, that's going to chill your blood.
It really does. And a lot of these encounters happen at night, but not always. And it's a lonely stretch of road up in the Northwoods, heavily forested area. It's dark. There are no street lamps, no street lights. So when you're driving, you kind of get a sense of being in a different realm altogether. And then when something like that happens, you know, it's enough to make you maybe try to avoid that road next time you're going by.
Is it one of those that's developed a reputation for, are people, as we mentioned before, and there are other locations like this that seem to appeal to certain people who aren't necessarily paranormal researchers, Chad, people on a dare and the like, that will go to the bridge trying to have an experience? Has it developed that kind of sort of magnet for people?
Not this place. A lot of other places in the book and around the state have, but this one's relatively unknown, even though I did include it in my first book 20 years ago. But I've spoken in that area quite a few times over the last few years. And without fail, whenever I talk about this case, people have no idea what I'm talking about. They had never heard it. So I'm always fascinated by how these legends can kind of make their way out, but where they're at doesn't permeate for a long time. They just kind of spread out far and thin. And that's always interesting because I'm looking for how these things affect certain towns or people, what they mean to us as a society. And I'm always amazed at some of these when the locals are the last to really know about it.
That's an interesting aspect to some of these, that there are places that get reputations, as you say, whereas the residents are either not many want to talk about it, or the majority don't know anything about it until they bump into somebody out from out of town saying, can you tell me where I can find the local ghost?
That's the way it always seems to work. We're always interested in stuff that's not where we are. Our hometown is boring. We don't like the legends. You don't staycation in your own place and go to these places. If you get a cabin on a lake and you go fishing, you don't fish off your dock. You try to go far away from your spot, even though you might have the best fishing spot. So people are always searching for something outside. So sometimes we tend to have blinders when it comes to our own backyard.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's something I was guilty of as well, Chad. I was looking at everywhere outside of Sheffield and didn't realise just how many strange stories I had on my doorstep. So speaking with yourself over the years, and also Linda Godfrey, who you've dedicated this latest version of the book to after a sad passing recently, always said to me, start on your doorstep. And the more I've spoken to people, the more I've realised that often, as you say, we somehow seem to take for granted what's right in front of us and cast our eyes afar.
One of my favorite things of doing this is that it encourages people to explore where they live. I was recently doing a program in the middle of Minnesota on haunted places, and a group of middle schoolers showed up, and they were doing their summer project trying to solve a mysterious disappearance from 100 years ago in their town. That was their summer goal, is to start researching the history and the background of their town and the legend and see if they could solve this unsolvable or unsolved disappearance of a lady in their town. So I'm always fascinated when these stories are a stepping stone for people to learn about local history or architecture or whatever they're fascinated by. These things are just a gateway to those.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, if we're talking about history, one of the most historical sites that you mention is the place known as the Devil's Punch Bowl, which is one of those things that often when we look at these strange places, and there are several of these in the US, and they're certainly near me as well, that have the name attached to the devil or Diablo or whatever, that seem to have had a reputation for strange things long before they would have had any concept of the word devil or even what the devil meant in the Christian world, really, Chad, because they'd had no sort of exposure to that religion until sort of the late 15th and early 16th century. So it's interesting that the Devil's Punch Bowl has built on a reputation that was cemented in the local Native American lore.
Punch Bowl is a natural area. It's a waterfall that comes down into a bowl-like area, giving it its name. And it was thought to be a sacred area for the indigenous people there. And it has taken on a supernatural reputation that when you go there, strange things will happen. You'll see these disembodied lights floating around that change in size, shape, and color. And I actually spoke with a group of teenagers that were parked in the makeshift dirt lot debating whether they should go down into the punch bowl when a ball of light started approaching their car. And they told me this ball of light actually entered inside their vehicle while they were waiting. So I asked them, I said, well, what did you do when that ball of light came into your car? And these kids all looked at me as though I was crazy. They said, we got out of the car, which, you know, most people probably would, but there's all sorts of activity down in the punch bowl, from disembodied spirits moving about to people hearing their name being called. There's a legend that if you take any water out of the little stream, it will remain cold regardless what you do to it. Put it in your car during the hottest day and leave it there all day. When you come out, it'll be cold to the touch. So there's so many stories here that you could do almost an entire book just on those legends of that one place.
Mm-hmm. Well, the section that made me raise my eyebrows when you're talking about some of these strange stories here is these encounters with gnomes, Chad.
Yeah. So this woman was out at the Devil's Punch Bowl hiking with her son, and it's a popular place. I went to college just right down the road from the Devil's Punch Bowl. I spent much of my free time just wandering the woods in the beautiful area. And she was walking. They were about to leave, going up the steps to get back to the parking lot, when she took one last look behind her to see the waterfall. And there, standing at the waterfall, was a gnome, you know, a fairy, a troll, goblin, leprechaun, sprite, the hidden people, the good folk, whatever it was. She said it was straight out of a Hollywood movie, like 3 feet tall, pointed ears, pointed cap. And startled, she grabbed her son and said, hey, do you see this thing? And by the time the sun spun around, the creature had either run through a little tunnel or vanished into the forest undetected. And it brings us back to the point I was talking about earlier, that she was a little shy and embarrassed about reporting this because she knew how it sounded, a gnome in Wisconsin. But she wanted to bring it forward in case anyone else had a similar experience and they might be more comfortable talking about it. And it worked because soon after I started talking about this case, a local football player from the university there told me he was taking his girlfriend down to the punch bowl to really scare her, to get her into the mood for Halloween. And they both got about halfway down the steps when they heard a growl from some creature they couldn't identify. And it scared them so much that he ran back to the parking lot. And I interviewed the young girl and the woman, young woman, and she told me she sat there for another 15 to 20 minutes just waiting to see if this thing would make another noise or maybe reappear. But then she jokingly said she felt bad and had to go rescue her boyfriend. So, you know, sometimes these stories do bring out other stories or other encounters.
Is it one of those locations unique with these kind of stories of gnomes in Wisconsin, Chad, or are there other parts of the state where there is this collection? Because I've noticed that it seems to be one of those parts of the US that is dependent on the people that settled there in sort of 200 years ago, 100 years ago, that a lot of them have brought European myths and legends with them. It's a very interesting concept, this, that people can sometimes suggest that these elementals, these creatures of the land, are attached to people, so they will follow them wherever they go, and therefore people aren't mistaking these things. These creatures have actually come across when the people did.
That's exactly right. When the immigrants came to this country, all non-Indigenous people here in America that came, they brought with them what they had, their clothing, their family heirlooms, the Bible, and the legends, the folklore, the monsters, the ghosts, and the like. And you're really right. They almost as though they had a passenger bag for the little gnome to ride in when it came here on the boats, because these stories do seem to be tied to certain communities or certain legends from the old countries. Again, any non-Indigenous person here, the story was brought with somebody. And there are many places in Wisconsin, but I found that a lot of the gnome stories are tied in with other legends. Like there's one up north in a small town called Fifield. It's Holy Cross Road and the railroad tracks are haunted. It's one of those stories that if you put your car in neutral, the spirits of young kids will push your car over the tracks to safety. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can sprinkle, you know, baby powder or flour on the back and then see little handprints. But the legend also tells of little people living there that if you throw a rock into the woods, the gnomes will throw the rock right back at you. So you're almost kind of playing the rock fight with these gnomes if you want. Again, where the legend, you know, the legend about the kids tell that a mother was driving her car over the tracks, it stalled out, a train hit them, and that's the origin story of the kids. But when it comes to these gnomes and creatures, we don't have an origin story. They just came over with the immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly plenty of room for them if they can just sort of hide, squirrel themselves away on some of the passing ships that came in. And obviously being smaller, Chad, there'd be more room for them.
Exactly. And that's assuming they can't, you know, hide themselves where we can't see them.
Yeah.
Physically can't see them. They could be, you know, sitting right next to you, taking a little drink of your Guinness while you're on your way over here.
Well, that's always my excuse when my glass gets empty.
Yeah. Yep. They drink a lot of pints, I've heard.
I think one of the strangest stories attached to Wisconsin is probably not based in the paranormal. It's based in true crime and one of the most notorious serial killers of the modern era who has influenced popular culture since the discovery of his crimes and what was going on. And the town of Plainsfield is probably synonymous with one person, and that is, of course, the notorious killer Ed Gein. And it's interesting when we look at certain serial killers or mass murderers, Chad, that very few of them tend to sort of cross into the paranormal for whatever reason, despite the fact that they've done a lot of terrible things to innocent people. And yet what's gone on at Gein's, even from him being captured and the strangeness of his particular crimes anyway, he seems to have developed a bit of a paranormal legend attached on top of all the awful things he did as a real person.
If any of your listeners are not familiar with Ed Gein, do not Google him. You'll be cursing my name all night. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, Paul, that in Plainfield, they still don't like talking about this legend, although Ed Gein was captured in 1957.
Yeah.
So it's been quite some time. Many of his victims' families are now out of the area or gone. People that knew him are few and far between because so much time has passed. But because he was such a weird character and committed some sinister deeds, people believe he has forever cursed the town of Plainfield. And they might be right because there are several locations that are attached to Gein that are thought to be haunted, including the cemetery where he grabbed a lot of his victims, the old hardware store that he actually took a living victim and took her life, to his old farmstead, which the townsfolk burned down, allegedly. But the land is still there, and people have experiences on it, not even knowing the history. One of the first times I went there, it's in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. And I had two women who were psychic who believed they could pick up on these spirits. And I just pulled over in the middle of the woods and said, let's check out this field. They had no idea where we were. And they said, no, we're not getting out. Too much negative energy here. We're not leaving the car. And we happened to be on the land of Gein. And I've spoken in that area quite a bit, and people tell me that it's still farmed. And so the owner hires local high school kids to help with the harvest and the maintenance of the farming. And one child came home and asked his parents, is there something weird about the place I'm working? And they kind of looked at each other and then explained a PG version of the story. And he said, because I saw somebody on the field, a ghost of a man who didn't look like a today's person walking through. He looked like he was from several decades ago. And the parents had to tell him that, yes, that's where Ed Gein lived and the whole story. And people still hear a see Gein's spirit walking around, or what's presumed to be him. And people will hear cries of women that are thought to be his victims on the land. But again, it's still one place that most people in Plainfield will not talk about it. They just want nothing to do with Gein. And all your listeners can mark my words here that I guarantee the next special on Netflix with the unexpected success of the Dahmer series is going to be Ed Gein, without a doubt. They're going to skip over John Wayne Gacy and go right to Ed Gein.
Yeah, I must admit, when I first stumbled across his story, I'm taken aback because it's one of those that, as I mentioned, this case has just influenced so many things over the years. I know people like Hitchcock have used it for basing certain thrillers on. I know he gave a nod to it in regards to the kind of person Psycho was based upon as part of all that. And obviously Silence of the Lambs. I know Jonathan Demme, when he directed the film, said that he spent a lot of time looking into Ed Gein's cases and then using that. I mean, obviously the baddie in Silence of the Lambs, spoiler alert, Buffalo Bill, is obviously following a very similar pattern, because Gein was obsessed with human skin. He had a real fetish for it, didn't he, Chad? And he built himself clothes out of it and used it as ornaments. And obviously Buffalo Bill in the film and the book is trying to create himself a suit made of human flesh.
If you're sensitive, now's a good time to maybe pause the mute button for the next minute or so. Because, yeah, Gein would dig up bodies of women that reminded him of his own deceased mother.
Mm.
And then he would then bring them home and use that material for lampshades, furniture. And of course, he would wear the material like a demented Halloween costume as he danced under the moonlight in his front yard. But Gein also had skulls in his house that he had converted into candlestick holders. Some of them were cereal bowls that he was eating out of. And what's fascinating to me is many people told me that they remembered that when Gein was captured in 1957, and it was all over the media, that was the first time they could remember their parents locking the front door. That until then, they just didn't lock the door at night. But once Gein was captured, and these stories stuck with people, I can't tell you how many people of a certain age tell me that they remember in grade school or middle school of hearing Ed Gein jokes when it happened. All these very eerie jokes. And just a couple of years prior to COVID, a woman of a certain age at my program afterward stood up and started reciting "Twas the Night Before Christmas" all about Ed Gein. Hmm. She had learned it as a child and it stuck with her for many decades. And you know, I wanted to cut her off because it was so spooky. Like, sit down, do not do this. But the crowd really enjoyed it. It was a fitting end to a haunted stories night because it was really creepy. And remember, this was 1957. People had never heard of anything like this before. It's not like today, like you mentioned, that some terrible thing could happen, some gruesome, grisly event, and tomorrow it's gone. You forget about it. The next story's on. Mm. But with Gein, people followed his trial, him being sent to the insane asylum, and people just could not get enough. There's a great YouTube video of someone recorded the auction of Gein's property before it mysteriously burned to the ground. And you can see hundreds of vehicles showing up to get a look at the auction that they were going to do. And a lot of people love it just because it's black and white and shows all these cool 50s automobiles that you can see. But we tend to think of sight seekers and legend trippers as a modern phenomenon. But it was happening back in the 50s. People had this true crime passion, even though they didn't know what to call it.
Mm-hmm. I think the most shocking part of the book, on top of everything else around Gein, is the fact that even back then, people were looking to make money out of it. And somebody was going to buy his house and turn it into a gory museum, which even in this day and age, Chad, I think would put a lot of people's noses out of joint. So God only knows how the people of Plainfield took that news in 1957. Because I know when he tried to buy it, then the house mysteriously burnt down. I don't think those two things are not connected, if I'm brutally honest. I think a local resident took matters into their own hand.
Without a doubt. And for years, the Gein car traveled to circuses and carnivals. It was a sideshow put in a tent. And for, you know, 50 cents a dollar, whatever it was, you could go look through it and go into the tent and see what he drove and all that gruesomeness, where, again, today that wouldn't fly. Here in Wisconsin a few years back, they were offering Jeffrey Dahmer tours, bus tours, where you could go to all the locations where he grabbed his victims from. But there was such an outroar of people crying about the distaste of it all that they canceled it, even though they had sold out many nights. But again, that's a little newer. That's a little more recent, where it's fresh in people's minds, where Gein has a little more distance and time. But yet the true crime people, I'm always amazed at how many people love true crime podcasts, all the Dateline, all those type of stories. So it doesn't surprise me. We've always had a fascination with those that kind of are outliers from the rest of us semi-normal people.
Well, it is remarkable. I know when I went to Edinburgh recently, one of the local shops had one of the death masks from the Burke and Hare trial, who were obviously the infamous grave robbers who then became murderers because they got greedy and they had a ready-made supply of fresh corpses to sell onto the local medical school. And you can see a bit of the stretched skin of one of them in just in this local shop, Chad. And some people don't know what it is. As soon as people ask about it and they get told, they go, oh, is that what that is? So that's from, what, 200 years ago. And people came from miles around just to view it. And the trial was watched by hundreds of thousands of people. And so was the execution. So it's something that's always been with us, whether people want to admit it or not. I think it's only now it's become classed as a form of entertainment for a lot of people, because the true crime genre is phenomenal across most of the world, I would suggest, these days.
It certainly is, and I think we've always had that fascination with the weird and unusual and the grotesque, dating back to obviously a lot of the public executions, and then even to some extent the freak shows of the carnivals, of these freaks of nature, as they were known, people suffering from genetic abnormalities or physical ailments or genetic disorders. They were put on display for the rest of the entertainment. So we've always been curious about it. But today, you know, it's a fine line between distasteful and just peeking in on the past.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those weird things that I think sometimes people don't like to realize, that people had always had an interest in the macabre and the violent for a very long time. I mean, here in the UK, we're renowned for some of our libraries up and down the country. Chad still owned books bound in human skin from murderers and vagabonds that were hung, and they just flayed their skin off and thought, oh, well, the best thing we can do with this now is bind our books with it.
Creepy.
Yes. I think it's called Anthropomorphic Biblipeggy or something. I think it is. But there's not many of them, but there's enough for you to think what on earth was going through somebody's mind that they thought that was a good idea. Well, I think after talking about Ed Gein, Chad, we'd be better off settling down for a drink somewhere. And one of the establishments in your collection has the wonderful name of the Old Baraboo Inn, which is a wonderful name.
And it's a very historic place. It was thought to be the stomping grounds of many Prohibition era gangsters and bootleggers. Some say Al Capone, Scarface himself, frequented the place quite a bit. And it was an old brothel where ladies of the night would work. And you could go during Prohibition and illegally drink. You could gamble. You could dance the night away. And now people walking by, unsuspecting citizens just walking by, will look up into the window of this historic building and see what appears to be some woman dressed like a flapper girl from the 1920s, just staring out the window. But when they try to get a closer look or maybe snap a photo of her, she simply vanishes into thin air. And I love the stories inside the bar. And as I always joke, you can go to any bar in Wisconsin and see weird things happen. But if you want them to be paranormal, that's a different story, because huge, heavy chairs will fall over, bar stools on their own. People will be tapped on the shoulder or hear their name called out. But when they spin around, nobody's there. But one of the more interesting legends of the OBI, as it's affectionately known, the Old Baraboo Inn, is that women using the restroom will report seeing the ghostly image of a cowboy-looking man hovering over them, watching them while they're in the restroom. And they'll come out complaining to the barkeeps about, you know, this cowboy being in the room, and the bartenders have to assure them that it wasn't patron of the bar, that it's just a ghost story, ghost legend. They don't have to worry that it wasn't a flesh and a live person. But and I'm amazed how many restroom legends I've collected over the years as well, of these ghosts seemingly preferring to haunt the bathrooms.
It would be interesting as well, because I know this is one of those wonderful buildings that's been restored, Chad, because it suffered an almost disastrous fire in the 1980s, I think. So obviously when it was renovated about a decade later, did they keep all the fixtures and fittings in the same locations? Because often I've thought about this, because when you talk about pubs, and as you mentioned there are loads here where they've got strange things going on in the toilets of a supernatural manner, as well as the normal patrons as well, Chad. So are the restrooms in the same location they always were? Have they moved? Or is it one of those things that nobody's really sure where they were? And it's just that location seems to attract the supernatural for some reason.
Seems as though they kept to the historic blueprint and layout as best they could of the establishment. And they're not certain why or who this cowboy may be. They've had psychics in who claim to have communicated with the spirit and have all sorts of origin stories for it. But they just think it's always been a hotspot of the gangster activity, and that many people met their fate down in the basement. They just disappeared. They were never found again. And we think of haunting sometimes being connected to places of great energy, of suffering, of death, unexpected accidents, suicides, murders, mob hits, that type of thing. And they have plenty of it. In fact, many people who are not psychically in tune will walk into the bar and say, nope, I don't want to be here. They just pick up on something and they leave. And you mentioned that we need a drink after talking about Gein. Well, this is another example of the pub actually promoting a ghost bomb drink. So you can go there and get ghost bombed, yeah, with their drink and maybe a ghost as well.
That sounds interesting. What's the ingredients of a ghost bomb, Chad?
You know, I'm brave, but I'm not that brave. So I have no idea. I've never done a ghost bomb. I'm guessing from the when I talked to them, they just kind of made up combined a bunch of fruity type things, because it's really the people that I've seen do it, they like it. Yeah. So it's nothing like a wild turkey or a okra or something like that that's going to really make you double think why you did it. But yeah, so and people will take photos by the sign that says I've been ghost bombed and the like, and they also have some apartment buildings and rooms above it that they'll let you stay in as an investigation overnight. And that's where a lot of people have strange encounters too.
Mm. I think the oddest thing about this particular haunting is that, yes, there are stories about a specific female ghost, but it seems that a lot of people see different female ghosts, Chad, which is quite unusual when we talk about a haunting that has a specific ghost attached to it. More people say, oh, it's the white lady, it's the grey lady, it's the red lady. Here, you've got one ghost that seems to be a more mature lady that people see, but also other people see people in different clothes, different hairstyles. That's a real strange thing about this that sets it apart, I think.
Interesting part for me is when we dive into the fact of, are these people all seeing different spirits, or are they seeing the same thing and perceiving it differently, or is the thing projecting itself differently? And years ago, when witnesses had, let's say, a UFO encounter, and researchers had them all put down what they saw and their story, and they were all completely different, skeptics would jump on that and say, all four of them saw something, but they can't even agree on what they saw. It looked different to all of them. They had to be making it up. Where today we're looking closer at those, knowing that people often perceive things different, or maybe, again, these things are projecting themselves in a different manner, where some people might just see a white fog, where other people see a lady in white. So I think years ago that was thought to kind of deny any credibility to a sighting, where today it's looked at in a completely 180-degree manner, where we expect people that sometimes see the same thing to report it looking different to them. So I don't know if there are multiple spirits in there that people are encountering, or if it's the same one in multiple form.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Could be, couldn't it? I mean, it could be the same person at different parts of their life. And that again, once again, would make it quite a unique haunting.
It stands out from your traditional. And for me, again, I'm left with more questions than answers. If you get people that are more, again, believe they're psychic or intuitive, you know, they may communicate with these spirits and get names and that. But for me, looking at it from the outside, more from the folklore perspective, I find it fascinating when people are seeing almost similar things, but something's a little bit off. The color of the dress, the length of the hair, the era in which they're dressed in. And again, I don't know. I don't know if it is they're seeing completely different things, or maybe not. And that's kind of the area that fascinates me the most these days. Whether or not these things are actually happening has taken a back seat for me to what they mean for the person and what they mean for the folklore itself.
Mm. Mm. Well, it seems, whilst they're obviously shocking to the witnesses, as hauntings go, this place seems quite gentle, really. But there is a darker force or feeling that people get in the basement. Everything above ground floor seems to be okay, Chad, but going beneath seems to cause some real problems for people. There seems to be something very dark and frightening that lurks down there, isn't there?
And the basement is normally off limits for the customers. It's a very steep old staircase going down, dirt floor in some parts, so original. And that's where people mainly get that odd feeling that something's not right. They shouldn't be there. They need to hightail it out of there as fast as they can. Where upstairs, it has more of what you would think of a pub, more of the party atmosphere. Everyone's jolly, jovial, having a great time, even if chairs are flipping over or bottles are moving on their own, or there's a cowboy keeping Tom on you in the restroom. It's more of a good-natured time, but things turn dark and eerie, literally dark, when you go down into the basement.
Is this one of those particular aspects that, as we've said, this venue has a very checkered past? Chad, is it one of those that perhaps darker things occurred in the basement out of the way and perhaps, sadly, people met their end? Is it one of those that the past is still a bit murky about how many people may have met their end in tragic circumstances?
They have no definitive records of what transpired in the basement. There are many legends of numerous people meeting their lives or their end down there, or wish they would have met their end down there. And many of the psychics that come through feel a sense of sorrow and dread and horror in the basement, picking up on unspeakable things that happened there. But like a lot of these places, you know, they don't have definitive proof. They don't have anyone who was ever arrested or newspaper archives, any of that nature. It's more speculation. But over the years, more and more people all have come to the same conclusion, as the basement is someplace you do not want to be.
Mm-hmm. How peculiar. I always find that quite strange sometimes, that you've got a location or a venue or a building, Chad, where you seem to have so many different things going on. And yet you've got something completely different on different floors. And it seems to be that the further up you get, the nicer it gets, for whatever reason.
I think it goes back to what John Keel would have called window areas.
Yes.
That so much is going on. And oftentimes when I'm at a place talking to people and striking out on maybe haunted stories, I try to broaden it out a bit and just ask about any weird or curious legends of the area. And they'll often say, well, I don't know of any haunted things at this place, but did you hear about this monster that was sighted years back, or a UFO flap that came through, or people always talked about this as being a portal to hell, those type of things. So sometimes when you expand the spectrum a little bit, you often get stories from people, because when you ask just about hauntings, they often think, well, they're not interested in anything else. So if I don't have a haunted story, you know, what's the point? So they'll say, no, I don't have anything. And you move on, where once you start digging a little bit deeper, you find that a lot of these areas are these almost portal areas where all sorts of weird things transpire.
Mm. Well, I think it's you only have to look at the Great Lakes and the different legends that apply to some of those, Chad, where you've got people who have ghostly encounters. There are lakes with UFO hotspots. There are strange lights seen. There are alleged to have monsters living in them. It seems that bodies of water in that particular area also just seem to be a whole window area of their own on top of everything else that's going on inland. I mean, you look at what goes on around Lake Superior and Lake Michigan and the variety of stories that applies to that. Is that something unique to the Great Lakes area, where you have such a variety to individual bodies of water?
I think there's something with the Great Lakes, most importantly Lake Superior, because as you alluded to, in Lake Superior, it's gigantic. People can't comprehend. It's pretty much an ocean there. It's just gigantic in area. And I have all sorts of legends from, as you said, ghost lights, UFOs, mermaids, men in black, sea serpents, portals, you know, ghostly ships, divers seeing underwater spirits, you name it, it's happening there. So I think there is some importance that so many early indigenous people, so many early settlers and explorers and fur traders all looked at the water with respect, that it was a sacred area, and they were picking up on it. And I think there's some truth to that, because there's such an assortment of legends there that statistically speaking, you'd have better chances of winning the lottery 12 times in a row than all these different phenomena happening in one area.
Yeah.
So people often ask in Wisconsin, where can I go for a paranormal experience? And I often refer them to Lake Superior. And the caveat of it is, I always say that even if you don't experience any of these things, you're going to have fun on the lake. I mean, the worst case scenario is you're going to spend your time up on one of the most beautiful lakes in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've mentioned that previously, Chad, when we've said one of the great things about this, regardless, is you get to see amazing locations, historical buildings. You go and see and meet people you would never have gone to if it wasn't for some supernatural occurrence being based there. It gets you to places you would never see under normal circumstances.
You wouldn't believe how many people travel with their friends, family, loved ones to these locations, and it ends up being something else about the trip that they remember more than the anchor story, if you will. Mm. That they hit a roadside attraction, they're at a mom and pop restaurant, they discover something that they had never seen before. So oftentimes it's the adventure of it that really plays back in our memory more so than the legend itself. And I found that fascinating with myself, that years ago I shifted from trying to prove or disprove these things to seeing it as an adventure of going to these places, collecting the stories, interviewing witnesses, trying to figure out fact from fiction, but also enjoying the legend of it. And I think that's why I shifted so many years ago from, you know, bringing a van load of equipment to today, basically going in with nothing more than a recorder, a camera, and the like, because I felt back then I was spending too much time setting up, monitoring, and breaking down the equipment that I wasn't enjoying the legend. I wasn't feeling myself immersed in the location. And I think that's very important rather than going out there and trying to prove or disprove. And I think that's one of the reasons I've been in this field so long, when many people that started out when I did have burned out long ago because they felt nothing was happening when they were going to these locations. And if that's your main goal, you are going to be disappointed quite often, where if you see the whole thing as an adventure legend trip, you're going to have fun regardless of whether a witch chases you out of the cemetery or not.
Mm-hmm. I think often when you get into this field, Chad, it very quickly turns from something you enjoy to becoming something more akin to a job. And I think when you transition from enjoyment to business, sometimes it loses its appeal, the sparkle disappears. And so when you are able to sort of recapture that initial love of the subject, and as you say, drink it all in rather than just focus, be so narrow-minded and focused on one particular aspect, that you end up enjoying it regardless. And if anything odd happens, it's just a bonus, isn't it?
Really is. I can't tell you how many times I felt dissuaded to go out to these places when I hear groups saying that after they investigated, they now have 8 hours of audio from 8 hours per five cameras of to listen to the next day to see if they picked up any weird sounds. And in my head, I'm thinking, I can't think of anything I'd rather do less than that than to do that. I did that when I first started out. And that's great if that's the way you like doing things. But for me, you know, that's a little too focused in, where, again, I'm trying to take this whole legend. Give you an example. Coming back from the Big Muddy Monster Festival last weekend, Kevin Nelson and I are stopping in a place in Illinois, a haunted cemetery where they have a devil's chair. And I love these devil chairs, ghost chairs, witches chairs, cursed chairs, death chairs, always a concrete chair in a cemetery where bad things will happen. This one's a little bit different because if you sit in this chair, not only will bad things happen to you like every other chair, but you can also make a deal with the devil that you can wish for whatever you want for 7 years, and then the devil will come collecting and take your soul after 7 years. But until then, you can live whatever life you want. So, of course, Kevin's too chicken to sit in the chair, as always. So I have him take a photo of me sitting in the chair, and I know him sooner sat in that chair, and he had the camera up when a piece of bark from a nearby tree came flying, slapped me in the face so hard Kevin thought, you know, I'd been hit and knocked over. It didn't hurt, but it was just strange because this tree was 25 feet away. But as soon as I sat down, I'm telling you, literally 2 seconds after I sat and was laughing at Kevin for being so afraid, this bark smacked me right across the face. And I thought, that's why I'm here. This is so cool. Probably just a coincidence, but hey, who knows? Maybe it was the spirit telling me not to sit in the chair. So I love that so much more than if I would just go over recordings hoping to hear some odd noise in the background. But that's the way I like doing it. Of course, there's no right or wrong way. It's not like we're performing surgery where the surgeon has to go through the procedure exactly the way they have to. You know, we're not doing anything like that. It's free reign out there.
Yeah. I think sometimes people can get too worried about what they're supposed to do rather than just going and enjoying the experience regardless, Chad.
Like you said, it turns into a job or something you really dread doing versus something you can't wait to go do again.
Well, the last location I want to visit before I let you leave to continue your breakneck schedule over the summer, Chad, is the wonderfully named Sock Road Bridge. And not only has it got a brilliant name, it's also got one of those really odd legends attached to it that on face value makes no sense at all. But it's just such a wonderfully named place that I couldn't miss a chance to mention this one.
This is another one where the origin story's not quite known. And again, I could have done an entire book just about bridges.
Yes.
And could have done another one about lonely stretches of road. And Sock Road Bridge is a rural area, and the origin starts prior to the new bridge because people will drive out there and say, this isn't very creepy at all. It just looks like your everyday modern bridge. Mm. But when they see some of the old photos of the original bridge and even its replacements, they think, okay, I can see why this is creepy. But the legend is that when you park out there in your car, all of a sudden you'll see blood oozing over the guardrails of the bridge. And where this blood's coming from, whose it is, nobody seems to know. And it happens when you park your car, which is a key component of a lot of these dares or legends. They involve your vehicle, stopping your vehicle, turn it off, and the bloody bride will be in your back seat, or your car won't start back up on locations. But here, its blood will appear and sometimes even appear on your vehicle. And I've never been able to trace back the origin of it, but people have these stories. So one of my favorite things is every place I write about or talk about, I visited. So I was there looking to get blood all over, but luckily or unluckily for me, you know, I was only attacked by mosquitoes instead of, you know, some supernatural being.
It's strange, this one as well, because like you say, do you suspect that the story is attached to the original bridge and it's just been sort of moved to the new one? Or do you just think that that particular stretch of water, whatever spans it, is going to attract something strange or have a reputation? Because that's the other odd aspect of this, as you've mentioned there. The bridge now is not the bridge that used to be there. It's a different bridge.
I think it's the crossing of the water. And of course, many people equate bridges and water with the paranormal, with obviously the old belief that spirits, much like vampires, cannot cross running water. So you would put a graveyard on the other side of town, across a lake or a river, hoping that that water would stop whatever was coming back to the town or village. And remember, a lot of these legends came with the immigrants and they settled near the waters, making it even more important that these legends grew up around bodies of water. And many people think that much like bridges connect water and earth in our realm, when you talk about it also in the spirit realm connects our world to whatever worlds you believe are out there. You know, the spirit realm versus our realm. So they're symbolic of that connection. And that holds some importance as well. And I think it's based on the water and the span itself rather than what material is used to bridge the gap. So I think it dates back long before the new bridge, but I don't think it's tied to the old bridge that as soon as they tear it down and refurbish a new one, that legend's gone. It continues. There's something about the area that's going to live as the water is there.
Mm. It is strange because obviously here in the UK, we've got part of the black dog law in certain parts. Chad has the same thing, that to get away from them, you have to cross water because they cannot cross it for whatever reason. So it is interesting how many legends seem to be attracted in Western culture to waters and bridges and things, even if you think of Scandinavia and the trolls living under the bridge and the nursery rhymes and things like that. It's surprising just how prevalent in cultures and societies in Europe and North America that there is these aspects to them, or these rules of something about water can protect you for whatever reason.
I think it's vital for our lives to have water. We need it. So it takes on that symbolic importance of life-giving. And I'm entirely fascinated by waterways and legends. And again, I think it would be very easy to do an entire series of books about waterways and all sorts of these paranormal legends. And the importance goes back to the indigenous people, that again, they put their settlements or their movements near water because they needed it. So it only makes sense that these legends would spring up around these bodies of water.
Well, I think to finish, Chad, since we've just considered the paranormal power of water, one of my favorite stories that you mentioned in the book takes us to Lake Michigan. And this wonderful character who ended up becoming known as Captain Santa, which is brilliant, because he made a living transporting Christmas trees over Lake Michigan for the people to help them celebrate Christmas. And so his ship ended up becoming known as the Christmas Tree Ship or the Christmas Ship. What a strange story, because obviously the fact that someone becomes known as Captain Santa because of their job is remarkable. And here we are, 100-odd years later, and this seems to be one of those stories that has it always been cited? Because the thing about this is that this is another one of those ships that disappeared in the Great Lakes for years, Chad. Nobody knew where it was. All people knew was it left harbour on a dark, stormy night in the Great Lakes and was never seen again. And then I think 50 years later, they finally found the wreck. So did the sighting start after it was discovered, or were people seeing this ship in the period from it disappearing to the wreck being found?
People thought it was a cursed ship from the minute it was on the docks up in northern Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, the UP as it's called. And he would sail from Chicago on Lake Michigan in the 1800s. And as you said, load up as many cut trees as he could and then sail them back to Chicago and sell them right from the docks. And he was dubbed Captain Santa because it was said that regardless of how little money you had to buy a Christmas tree, if you showed up, you would leave with a Christmas tree. So they dubbed him Captain Santa. But on the return trip, people warned him rats were scurrying the ship, which was a bad omen. Terrible, treacherous weather was on its way. They warned him not to go, but his reply was said to be, "The people of Chicago need their Christmas. I have to go." And then for decades, they were never heard or seen from again until some divers found the wreckage on the bottom of Lake Michigan near Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And since that time, people have had legends. Now, I learned about this much, much later, and I've been digging into it, trying to find some of the old legends. And it appears that the legend of this ghost ship, because when the divers went there, they filmed and took pictures, and you can still see, amazingly, many of the Christmas trees in pretty good condition on the ship underneath the water. And people still swear they see the Christmas tree ship, that when they look out, they see a ship that looks like it's from the 1800s, but when they pull out the binoculars or try to get a closer look, it's not there. It's a phantom ship. And I'm almost certain these stories happened long before the wreck was even found. As far as my research shows today, that these stories originated almost as soon as the ship went missing. And that's quite common, that oftentimes legends will take time to percolate and time to build and time to settle, but others happen almost instantaneously. And it's leaning now that this legend happened as soon as they made the cursed decision to travel back in that terrible weather.
Remarkable, really. There is something about ghost ships I've always been fascinated with, Chad, from the stories of the Marie Celeste and the Flying Dutchman to some of the strange things that are seen in the Great Lakes and other stories that seem to come from all around the world. There's something, I don't know, there's something more supernatural or scarier about when you see a ghost ship. I'm not sure if it's the power of the sea or what, but there seems to be a real sort of emotional response when people witness such a thing. There's always these cliches of it being a dark, foggy night or whatever, and people might see strange shapes and these boats just disappear into thin air. So I just find them fascinating.
For me, it's always the fear of not being able to quickly get away. That yes. If you're out on the water, you know, on land, you could run, grab your car, grab a bicycle, whatever you have to do to get yes. away. There's more shelter. There's more places to hide and cower. But out on the water, you know, there's only one way off, and usually that's straight down.
Yes. Sadly so. Sadly so, Chad. Well, it's a brilliant collection with some incredible stories, fascinating locations, some wonderful legends, and some hair-raising spirits that lurk about there, Chad. So I know, as we've mentioned, you've already had a hectic schedule on top of the book being reissued, updated, as we touched on. So I'm amazed at your tenacity and workload, Chad, because I often see you inviting people to yet another talk at a library or whatever. Is there any slowing you down?
Knock on wood here, no. On average, I'm doing about 200 lectures a year throughout usually the Midwest. And when I go to these things, I'm always digging. I'm always looking for something nearby. And that's the source for a lot of these legends, is that every single time I present, every single time, I'm learning something new from someone. Someone will have a story, a legend, folklore that I've never even heard of. Sometimes it's paranormal. Sometimes it's paranormal adjacent. And that's what keeps me going, is that I'm never just saddled with the same legends. I'm always learning new and fascinating things, and there's no end to it. Absolutely, it's a black hole, or, you know, nothing will ever stop these legends, and that's what I love.
So as you say, you've got plenty of these upcoming appearances as well. Have you got any more conferences coming up, Chad? Are you being whisked around the Northern American continent on the hunt for various monsters for the rest of the summer?
Yes, I'm actually going to be heading out to some of our national parks this summer, doing some legends. One of my favorites is the Badlands of South Dakota. There's a banshee legend that I've been to many times, but I want to dig deeper. And then I'll head out near North Dakota for my favorite national park in the world, Theodore Roosevelt National Park, where there's some more ghost stories, and I'm hoping to maybe encounter a phantom bison or something when I'm there. So I'm spending the summer tracking down national parks and circus legends of my home state, because I'm working on a small monograph of circus folklore that involves the paranormal. Like in the 1800s, the great airship sightings from 1896 to 1898-99, believe it or not, many newspapers were blaming all those, what we would consider a UFO, these giant airships that thousands of people in hundreds of Midwestern cities saw. Newspapers were blaming them on the Ringling Brothers Circus, saying it was an advertising ploy for the circus. So I'm collecting all these legends of the phantom elephants and all of these circus legends and putting them into a small monograph. Again, paranormal adjacent, not necessarily strictly paranormal, but pretty weird.
Yeah. Well, as always, Chad, there is something about circuses and train crashes that should be a Fortean subject in itself. The amount of strange things that are written off or explained away as being responsible from escaped animals in a terrible circus crash. And I think, I'm trying to think who I spoke to. I spoke to somebody once who said that when they dug into it, they could find one in four states that had happened, and there wasn't even any animals involved in that particular one. So is that something else that you stumble across? Because as we've spoken over the years, Chad, and I'm sure you're very aware of this, circus train crashes seem to be synonymous with some explanations for strange creatures all over the states.
Wonder if that was David Weatherly, because David, like myself, has an affinity for circus legends and lore. He loves the circus as much as I do. And you're absolutely correct that every unknown creature spotted throughout the Midwest, especially, was blamed on an escaped circus animal. So I don't know how any of these circuses survived because they were losing so many of their animals.
Yes.
They had to have gone broke.
Yes.
But what's fascinating is when communities said it was a tiger from a Adam Fourpaw's circus or something. When they asked the circuses, they weren't missing any of their animals. So it just doesn't. Yes, circus animals did escape. Circus animals were never captured, some of them. But to the extent that hundreds upon hundreds of sightings and stories were all blamed on circuses, again, circuses were much too careful with their animals because the expense of them. Replacing any of their animals was terribly expensive, and they did not want to lose the money.
Mm, yeah. It would, every time this subject comes up, Chad, I always think I'm going to look into this and find out where these have happened. Because I know there's been a couple of really bad ones, but certainly not to the extent like you say. It would be probably the most dangerous job in the world going on local legends with the amount of circuses that crash on a train. You would say, hey, I've heard about Barnum's. I'm not getting on this train. I know what happens if you're in a circus.
People have mapped out circus crashes on trains. That's well documented. People have mapped it, pinpointed. So all that's already done. Now you just have to look at, were there any reports of strangeness or escapees that match up with those crashes? And a lot of the times, unfortunately, with train crashes, the animals die. Either the blunt force of the crash or the fire that ensued after would consume so many of these animals. Fire was the biggest threat to circuses, more so than anything else. And that took a lot of lives of the animals and performers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to that, Chan, because usually when you say you're releasing a smaller book, it's usually as chock full as anything else you do. I know your Lumberjack one was a prime example of that, Chad, with some of the incredible stories in there. So is that the next project on your agenda, or are you still looking at doing something else further down the line, or have you uncovered another monster legend that deserves publicity?
Well, I'm doing about four or five projects, as most of your listeners probably are doing the same. I have four or five going in many different directions. There's not one I'm doing on a specific legend or creature yet that's not a monograph, which is just a smaller a book that I run across all these stories that are fantastic. They're too detailed and too terrific for an article, too long, but not quite big enough for a full-size book without adding too much filler. So I'm doing a series of monographs that are almost like cliff notes of some of these legends. So doing a kind of a combination of full books and monographs.
Fabulous. Well, I look forward to whatever project you've got coming up down the line for us, Chad. So where can everybody get hold of the latest book, follow your work, and also get hold of any copies of your previous books that we've discussed before?
Obviously, my website. You can get any book anywhere you buy books, or you can go to your sites, Paul, and just click under co-host, and you'll see my name pop up on the site. So, yes, I recommend that's how people find me.
Excellent. Well, I'll put links, as always, under your tab on my website, Chad, for the co-host's body of work. And I want to say thank you, as always, and I look forward to your 64th appearance when you join me, no doubt, in the near future, my friend. Thank you, as always.
Keep an eye out.